So all of these ways of training the attention, we found three in the Christian and the Buddhist traditions. Mindfulness of breathing, presented as a very good way to calm the agitated mind. The Buddha said that among all these types of samadhi or attentional training that he taught, he said for people with very discursive minds, with a lot of conceptual, you know, chit-chat going on, a lot of chatter going on, he said mindfulness of breathing is the most effective technique. And so there's that. Both traditions have it. Then both traditions continue the training of attention, but now more in the area that is bound to give rise to insight, and that is attending to the mind itself, observing the phenomena, the mental images and provocations of the mind, and so forth arising. Both of these have this. Then both of these invert inwardly from the mind into the very awareness itself. All of this can be seen as strategies of developing and refining attention skills with greater and greater subtlety. But then there comes a time for contemplative insight in the Buddhist tradition called vipassana, or insight, contemplative insight. In the Christian tradition, they call this contemplation, where it's no longer simply a training of attention or an attempt to calm the mind, but it's now really a quest for knowledge, for experiential insight, and specifically insight that will liberate, not simply acquire more knowledge that you can write a book about. So back to St. Gregory of Palamas. Through grace, it's an interesting term. It's not one that we encounter much in Buddhist translation. But grace is something that is simply given, not something that you assiduously acquire by the sweat of your brow and by putting in a lot of hours, and I earned that, but rather simply by sitting, then something is granted freely. And so using the Christian terminology, through grace, God in his entirety, stunning statement, God in his entirety, in the Christian view, God, creator of the entire universe, his awareness saturating the entire universe, infinite. I mean, God is infinite. He said, God in his entirety penetrates the saints in their entirety. Total saturation. But now a saint, we tend to think of as a human being. I mean, not infinite, right? You only live a certain number of years, your body's only this big, your psyche's only this large, you got a finite container. That's what human beings are generally concerned with, or regarded as finite, here we are. And he's saying God in his entirety penetrates the saints in the entirety. So it seems like a finite vessel becomes the container for something infinite. That doesn't make any sense. So maybe the vessel is shattered, because it was only held together by grasping anyway. God in his entirety penetrates the saints in their entirety, and the saints in their entirety, oh, that's even more astonishing. The saints in their entirety penetrate God entirely. A total comprehension. I mean, this is an extraordinary claim. Almost entirely forgotten, I think, in contemporary Christianity. Time and time again, we read in mainstream Christian writings, God is unknowable. It's a matter of faith. We just have to have belief. We'll only know in the hereafter. And here's a mainstream Christian. This is wisdom forgotten. The saints in their entirety penetrate God entirely, exchanging the whole of him for themselves and acquiring him alone as the reward of their ascent towards him, for he embraces them as the soul embraces the body, enabling them to be in him as his own members. The intellect, because of its freedom from worldly cares, is able to act with its full vigor and becomes capable of perceiving the ineffable goodness of God. Utterly experiential claim. There's no mention here of, well, just believe this or have faith in this or accept this on authority. He's talking about perceiving. As we perceive colors, we perceive sounds, perceiving directly the ineffable goodness of God by way of unity. That is a total mutual saturation in entirety. Incredible claim. One would think this had to be written by some New Age hippie. You know, out in La La Land. But no, this is one of the greatest patriarchs in the whole Greek Orthodox tradition, one of its most renowned contemplatives. What's become of this? Where? I mean, this is extraordinary. How could we have lost sight? How could the Christians have lost sight to the extent that they have to such transcendent wisdom? We slip up, but you notice how, in a way, uninteresting the dates are. whether it's 7th century, it's 2,500 years ago, it's the 14th century, it's the 17th century, have you noticed it's kind of like timeless? Like, who cares? There was an evolution, like in the 7th century, they got to mindfulness of breathing, and then the 10th century, then they got to observing the mind. It's not like science. I mean, Newton beat Galileo. Maxwell beat Newton. Newton beat both of them, you know, and on we go. Dirac then synthesized quantum mechanics with relativity theory. There's a definite progression there, right? In the contemplative, I'm not saying there's no progression at all, that it's completely timeless, but we see the dates seem to be irrelevant. And I put them in there to show how interesting it is that they're irrelevant. We happen to slip now to the late 19th century. Dujom Lingba, the author of my favorite all-time text, The Vajra Essence, which I've translated, he is one of the great, great meditation masters of Tibet in the 19th century. He writes now of contemplative insight, vipassana, once you have recognized all phenomena included with samsara and nirvana, in other words, every possible aspect of reality, recognize all phenomena as the play of your own appearances alone. All of this is simply displays of awareness. You will actualize the great all-pervasive realm of pristine space, which is self-originating, spontaneous, primordial consciousness. He's referring now to something that is infinitely larger than what was described earlier by the Panchen Lama when he's describing your own psyche slipping into a luminous vacuity, which is rather local. I mean, it seems to be quite boundless, but it's really the continuum of your own awareness. It's called the substrate consciousness. It's individuated. It's your own space. You're tapping into it. But what Dujom Lingba is referring to now is something where it's exactly beyond interiority. Dujom Lingba, when he's describing the attention, the practice of observing the mind, he gives a brilliant presentation of it. I think you would agree, Vidya. Brilliant presentation of it. And then he says, just as Panchen Losen Chukyi Gyantsen said, you attend to it and then the thoughts start to dissipate. The mind settles into its natural state, aware of simply a luminous vacuity imbued with bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality. And he said, that's like a holding station. That's a relative ground. But it's just holding. And then that's through shamatha practice, simply through the training of attention, settling the mind in its natural state. But then one ventures into contemplative insight practice, vipassana, or in this case, the great perfection, insight practices, and you literally break through this individuated space that is the interiority from which your own individual psyche arises. That is the deep interiority. And now what Dujom Lingba is speaking about is breaking through that interiority, that withdrawal from the outer into the inner, coming to the ground of the inner, and then shattering the ground of the inner until you tap into something that is primordial, non-individuated, not located in space or in time. This all-pervasive realm of pristine space, due to the unceasing power in the nature of primordial consciousness. This is Dharmakaya, Buddha mind, Buddha nature, pristine awareness, all of these synonyms for this ultimate ground dimension of awareness. Due to the unceasing power in the nature of primordial consciousness, there is total knowledge and total awareness of all phenomena. Sounds like what was stated before, the entirety of God is immersed. The entirety of the saint penetrates God, a total, entire, mutual penetration. Total knowledge and total awareness of all phenomena without its ever merging with or entering into objects. That is, your awareness never dissolves into, gets encapsulated into, gets incorporated into objects. It never enters into objects any more than space dissolves into or gets sucked into matter. It is simply all-encompassing, all-embracing, present, luminous, but not grasped or clutched. Primordial consciousness is self-originating. It does not arise from some other causes and conditions. It is naturally clear or luminous. It is free of outer and inner obscuration. It is the all-pervasive, radiant, clear infinity of space free of contamination. Contemplative insight. This looks to me like a very non-trivial sequence of renunciation, even identifying the sources of suffering, The whole impulse to set out on a spiritual path, the basic strategies for calming the mind, strategies for observing the mind, strategies for awareness of awareness, strategies for breaking through the interiority of awareness, one's own individual awareness, due to something, to the infinite. In Christianity, obviously, God. In Buddhism, the mind, the Buddha mind, or primordial consciousness. Parallel after parallel, and bear in mind, in both of these traditions, these are anything but kind of like, I didn't cherry pick and say, oh, how can I find anything here that looks similar, but rather took absolutely core practices to each of these traditions. By the way, if you're interested in checking out Western sources for that sequence of practices, when I first encountered this with unprecedented clarity in my continuum in a book by Martin Laird called Into the Silent Land. And I was reading through it, and I said, by cracky, he's identified the three shamatha practices I've used in the Shamatha Project. And it's all from Christianity. Every single source he gave was from the Christian tradition. Not a single Buddhist source at all. So in other words, it's autonomous. It's not, it would be fine if they borrowed, you know, borrowed and lent to each other, and there's nothing wrong with that. But the fact that they didn't, or at least we have no grounds for believing that they did, makes it, to my mind, all the more interesting. So Penchen Losan Chögyi Gyanzen, back there again in the 17th century, extraordinary scholar, I mean, enormous erudition, as well as a deeply versed, experienced contemplative. He refers to the multiplicity of contemplative traditions within Tibet. As some of you may know, there were four orders of Tibetan Buddhism. Some of these even have sub-lineages of particular modes of contemplative inquiry, using the Tibetan chö, or the cutting through, poa, the transference of consciousness, Dzogchen, the great perfection, Mahamudra, the great seal, Vipassana, insight, Majjhimaka, the middle way. These are clearly different lineages, different approaches. They each has its own distinctive qualities. And he surveys these different modes of contemplative inquiry within the pluralism, the diversity of practices and theories within Tibetan Buddhism. And with this kind of this eagle's eye view, this large view, again, given his great erudition, but also his profound insight experientially, he said, if these different traditions within Buddhism, if these are examined by one who is well-versed in the scriptures, that is, knows what the tradition stated, and reasoning, is able to think clearly, by which one distinguishes between provisional and definitive meanings, and that is, what are the core themes? What are within a spiritual tradition, this is really core, within Christianity or Buddhism or different traditions, where are the timeless truths? Are there any? The definitive truths. These are not embedded or, how do you say, configured by a particular culture. Not configured by a time, a place, social, economic influences, the kind of things that scholars of religious studies just make their living out of studying, is provisional truths. Yeah, this is true, but it's true in Mount Athos in the 13th century, in the Greek tradition. It's true for them, but of course it's not true outside of them. It's a localized truth. It's a provisional truth. It's contingent upon circumstances, time, place, culture, and so forth. It's true that in the United States, one should definitely drive on the right-hand side of the road, because that's the correct place to drive on the road. Okay, that is true, but in England they have another provisional truth. And so there are truths in religion that are true only for people in that religion. Nothing wrong with that. But are there truths? Have I pointed out some? And just taking two, a representative tradition from the West, I could have chosen Judaism or Islam, especially if I knew more about them, which I don't. Instead of Buddhism, I could have chosen Hinduism or Taoism. I simply happen to know more about Buddhism. So I chose two traditions representative of Asia and the Mediterranean basin and the Near East. Not because they're better, but just because of the, how would you say, peculiarities of my own background, these are the ones to which I've had a lot of exposure. But if one approaches these two traditions, and then with clear understanding of the tradition and a clear sense of reasoning, of discerning intelligence, recognizes here are truths that are provisional, or maybe they're only metaphorical. By the time we got to the 1830s and geological discoveries were made about the age of the earth, then a lot of Christians were doing some fast backtracking and thinking, well, you know, the 7 days wasn't to be taken literally. There are still a very significant portion of American Christian fundamentalists who are saying, well, never mind all of that, the geology business, you know, it's still 7 days. and it took place 7,000 years ago, it's kind of hard to take seriously unless one is, how do you say, thoroughly indoctrinated in a way that enables one to ignore reality. And so as science has progressed, actually science has been as one of the greatest servants to religion. So often it's presented as an adversary. But if religious people are really intent on truth and not simply of protecting their own creed, then truth is truth. What we're looking for are timeless truths that are not simply artifacts of a particular culture, time, place, personalities, economic, social influences, and so forth. Science is actually doing religion a great service in pointing out, you know, you may have been taking this literally, but if you did, you should get over it. And there are also statements in the Buddhist tradition. I'll give one of the easiest low-hanging fruits that you'll find not from the teachings of the Buddha, but in later commentarial literature, that the distance from the earth to the moon and the distance from the earth to the sun, same distance. It makes perfectly good sense because the sun and the moon are the same size. And the eclipse, have you noticed how neatly they... Did you see the lunar eclipse a couple of weeks back? I mean, isn't that a perfect fit? I mean, that should make it perfectly clear they're exactly the same size. Otherwise, why would they fit so perfectly in this, you know, in this beautiful universe where we're the center? And so since they're the same size, they must be... This is good reasoning. Since they're the same size, which they obviously are, then they must be the same distance. 250,000 miles, 98 million, you know, give or take. Not too close. And so the Buddhists have to do some fast backtracking on that one. And the Dalai Lama has said repeatedly that if science can clearly provide empirical evidence or some very compelling argument that repudiates some Buddhist assertion, then we're just going to throw out that Buddhist assertion because we're interested mostly in truth, secondarily in preserving a tradition. Pretty cool coming from a religious leader. So distinguishing what are the provisional, what are the definitive meanings, by so doing, they are seeing these different traditions, these different contemplative traditions, not as mutually incompatible, like hot and cold, but as coming down to the same point. So he's making the statement in terms of the multiplicity of traditions within the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and bearing in mind, they debated a lot. They got really keen on debates. I mean, the Gelugpas debating the Kagyupas debating the Sakyapas debating the Nyingmapas. And I was trained in that for years, you know, really getting out there and trying to present one's point and defend it logically and so forth. All of that is very good for sharpening the blade of one's discerning intelligence. But when it's all is said and done, these practices, these great traditions are yielding very profound insights and transformation, because the insights being sought are insights that transform and liberate. Coming down to the same point. Now he's speaking in a kind of a safe terrain. Although there are exclusivists, there are elitists in Tibetan Buddhism for sure, that say only our tradition, the other ones are good only insofar as they are correspond exactly to ours. And, you know, that happens too. I mean, sectarianism, fundamentalism crops up wherever human beings are walking around. And Tibet was certainly no exception to that. But here this great master was saying, you know, they boil down to the same point. Now let's come out to the global context, Christianity and Buddhism. Could this be the case that if one is very well versed in both, has very clear reasoning, and possibly has some deep contemplative insight to boot, despite the very important differences in doctrine, are their core insights mutually incompatible, or do they come to the same point? Interesting question. I want to close with just a couple of slides. I guess five, raising a question that's actually one of the most pressing for me. I will say from my own perspective, I'm deeply impressed. I mean, beyond impressed. I feel a sense of reverence when I'm reading these accounts of contemplative practice within the Christian tradition. It just strikes me as just deep and clear and pure and penetrating.